Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty good, Justin. How are you feeling tonight?
I'm okay. You watched a show recently?
Right. You know, I don't know if anybody knows this, but because we cover true crime, I think in the last few years, it's been more difficult for me to watch true crime documentaries, despite people writing in and saying, you have to watch this new documentary on Netflix or Amazon Prime, whatever. It's mostly just because I'm usually getting enough true crime in just all the research and reading that we do. But sitting down and watching documentaries, I think I do it about once a year at the most. I recently watched something on Netflix, Why Did You Kill Me? This is a pretty interesting documentary because it has to do with family taking action after a loved one is murdered and getting to the bottom of why she was murdered. The family members, they definitely have a journey where they have to look at their own lives and reevaluate things as they go. And I think that's pretty powerful.
I'll have to check it out. I haven't watched it myself, but I will on your recommendation.
And I definitely feel like towards the end of this documentary, Justin, you'll almost feel like they're speaking your language.
I'm sure. Just from the little bit that I know of it, I'm sure they will be.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling T-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
So with that, tonight's case, Aaron, is one that happened back in the 80s, and it was a cold case for decades. Normally, I would say that I like to cover a case that hasn't been resolved, in the sense that I would like to be able to figure it out and know if I was right, but this one did come to a conclusion, and it wasn't exactly the conclusion that a lot of people, at least the media or law enforcement, might have thought. But at the same time, the victims' families, they seem to have known from the start. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the 1986 murder of Sherry Rasmussen, a 29-year-old nurse who was newly married to a husband, John Rutten. Let's talk about this murder, Justin.
Yeah, it was the morning of February 24th, Sherry had actually called in sick to work. She just apparently wasn't feeling well, but this was pretty unusual behavior for her because she was a workaholic. She took great pride in what she did. Her husband, John, says he left for work at 7:20 a.m. They had a condo in Van Nuys, California, and at around 9:45 a.m., neighbors noticed that the Rutten's garage door was open, but there weren't any cars inside. Now, John always closed the garage door behind him. They were really good about it. So John would try calling Sherry throughout the day just to check in, like husbands do, but she never answered her phone. Sherry's sister was also trying to reach her, but didn't get any answer either. John thought that maybe she decided to go into work, and, you know, being a nurse, you get busy. So he called the hospital, and the admin there informed him that Sherry wasn't at work that day. At 12:30 p.m., a housekeeper claims they heard loud noises of people fighting and slamming stuff around, and then a car speeding off. This housekeeper was cleaning a condo next to theirs. After work, John goes out, runs a few errands. He goes by the bank. He actually picked up a pair of shoes he'd been wanting to buy for a while, picked up his dry cleaning, and returned home just before 6 p.m. He pulled up to his condo, and he saw that his wife's car was missing and that there was broken glass, like on the driveway and the walkway. Now, the way this condo is laid out, there is a balcony above the garage door. He didn't know where the glass was from, but it would end up being from the glass doors and windows on that balcony, and the glass had fallen down. He noticed the garage door was open. He's sort of on guard immediately because not only is his home not how he left it, but he hasn't been able to speak to his wife all day. And they communicate so much that if she had gone to work, if she had gone out to grab some dinner to bring home, whatever it was, it's normal for them to have discussed this. He always knows where she is. So what happened when he entered the condo?
We entered the condo after walking up the steps, and the first thing that he noticed was a bloody handprint on the wall. Also, the door leading into the house from the garage was partially open. So he entered his home, and that's when he saw Sherry, his wife, dead on the floor. And his first action was to retrieve a blanket and place it over her face, then call 911 at 5:59 p.m.
He could tell from her eyes and her skin color that she'd been dead for a while. She'd been badly beaten. She'd been shot in the chest. And rigor mortis had already kind of set in. Her hands were actually off of the ground, like she was so stiff. Obviously, he's come outside of the condo after he's called. His neighbor, a man named Alan, saw him just moments later and asked him what was wrong. And he was just totally out of it. He said, "Sherry's dead. She's dead." So at this point, his neighbor actually sidestepped into the condo and looked for himself. He said that he saw a pool of blood in the living room. It was over 3 feet wide. Chairs were knocked over, and the entire lower floor of the condo had been damaged. Now, police arrive and see that the condo's been ransacked. Sherry's been shot with a .38 caliber revolver. She's been clubbed with a plaster statue and bludgeoned over the head with miscellaneous objects. There were wounds on her wrists that indicated someone had tied her up. There were serious injuries all over her face. Because there was stereo equipment and TVs and things that had been like ripped from the wall, but nothing obviously taken, detectives thought maybe robbers came into the home and weren't expecting her to be there. So this was a botched robbery and they killed her. And Aaron, I saw some crime scene photos of this. It was a prolonged struggle is how they describe it, but it was a fight for her life. They didn't find any signs of forced entry, but they did find bits of her fingernails, a bite mark on her left arm, and a blanket that was full of bullet holes and gunshot residue. So they assume that that was maybe the final killing shots, and they used the blanket to muffle the gunshots.
And also, they never recovered the gun, right? I mean, like, the gun wasn't there.
No, the gun wasn't there. I was going to say there was no murder weapons found, but they found, you know, the statue and some other things that were used to beat her with. So it's kind of assumed that maybe this perpetrator had tried to beat her unconscious and she kept fighting. So then they had to finish her off with a gun, but they didn't want to use the gun because they knew it would be loud. But that housekeeper next door that was cleaning, she didn't report hearing any gunshots. She only heard just loud noises and then somebody speeding off.
Really, the only witness, Justin, was that housekeeper that was next door, Evangelina.
That housekeeper gave a time in the morning that she heard this going down. Investigators are going to look at John, the husband, and say, "Where were you?" He was at work. He had a solid alibi. So that's when investigators switch gears and say, well, it looks like a robbery gone wrong.
But as we know, just because you seem to have a solid alibi doesn't mean you couldn't have set something up. The odd thing, though, is he and Sherry had only been married for about 3 months. They do ask him, "Will you come in for an interview? We need to talk with you." And he was very cooperative.
Let's go back. How did Sherry and John meet? What is their relationship like? What's their background?
Sherry and John met at a party in 1984. He was an undergrad student and Sherry was in grad school. One thing you should know about Sherry was she graduated college at age 16. Apparently, they connected immediately and were dating, very serious about each other. One note here is that at the time, John had been dating another person. But as soon as he met Sherry, that was it for him. They became engaged in 1985, the following year. From all accounts, it was a very happy marriage. But again, they only had been together as a married couple for a few months.
Now, before John had met Sherry, he had, I guess, what he would call a on and off again or friends with benefits relationship with a woman named Stephanie Lazarus. He and Stephanie had met in the early 80s. He was studying mechanical engineering at UCLA, and Stephanie was a political science major. They lived in the same dorm. They played intramural basketball together. Like I said, they were just dating on and off. Apparently, John wasn't quite as into her as Stephanie was into him. And when he started dating other people, such as Sherry, apparently this didn't go over well with Stephanie. She was madly in love with John and obviously didn't understand why he didn't feel the same way.
This actually came to a head of sorts because after John and Sherry became engaged, Stephanie reached out to John and said, I would like to talk with you. And she invited him over to her condo, and he went. So she put it all on the line. She said, I need you. I want you. I'm in love with you. And he slept with her. And basically, that was his way of giving her closure, he said. But that didn't work out too well because then he had to tell Sherry the next day what happened.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, guys are so dumb. You don't sleep with somebody to give them closure, but in his twisted mind, that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I have no idea what his reasoning really was, if that was true or not, but he did go through with things with Sherry and he confessed to her. So he told her all about it and said, please forgive me. Please don't let this ruin our relationship. I really want to be married to you. You're my person. So she said, okay. I mean, I'm sure it was a little more difficult than that, but John cut off all contact with Stephanie.
Stephanie, well, she didn't exactly appreciate being sidelined at this point. Just a few days after the engagement, some things kind of went down, right?
Stephanie went to Glendale Adventist Hospital to confront Sherry, and she said, if I can't have John, nobody else will.
That's pretty threatening.
Right. And Sherry, what she did after that was just simply tell her parents and some friends, as well as John, all about Stephanie visiting her at her work.
Stephanie would do little things to harass her. She would call and hang up, stuff like that. One day in January, Sherry had returned home to their condo to find Stephanie inside wearing her police uniform. And this is a little odd. She asked her to leave. Another time, Stephanie had stopped by the house to ask John to help wax her skis. I don't know if that's what the kids were calling it back then, but it's pretty inappropriate, especially when you've threatened this man's wife. You're unwelcome. This stressed Sherry out so much that she actually told John, like, I might leave you. This is way too much baggage. I don't want to deal with this. And she said, this woman scares me. She's threatened me and she's a police officer. So what am I supposed to do here? She just pleaded with John to tell Stephanie to leave him alone. John didn't seem to take this very seriously. And he told Sherry, don't worry about Stephanie. Just ignore her because, you know, problems like that just go away, right?
We don't know how serious they can become. And that's why it does feel like stalking is taken more seriously these days. But back in the 80s, from all accounts that I read, I don't think it was taken seriously enough. It was one of those things where it's like, sure, someone might be following you, but you haven't died. Remember that bit? But did you die? It seems like that was the response.
Yeah. And it's, well, they haven't broken any laws. It's a free country. So whatever. But Sherry told her father that someone had been following her, someone that was dressed like a man, meaning obviously a woman dressed like a man was stalking her. This was just days before her death. Her father told the police, but nothing really came of it.
So go back to the investigation. The police looked into John Rutten. They can't see anything that would tell them that he had it out to kill his wife. And he had a very good alibi. So they are thinking, this is probably a robbery gone wrong. After all, things were moved. I think pretty much all the stereo equipment was stacked next to Sherry's body. So they start canvassing the condos in that neighborhood on February 25th. What did they find when they started canvassing the neighborhood?
Well, they spoke to neighbors, and one of them told them that two gardeners stopped by her house to drop off a purse they had found outside. Well, this purse ended up belonging to Sherry, had her wallet and driver's license inside. A few days later, another woman reported to them that she heard a knock on her door and saw a man that she didn't know standing outside. So she ignored the knock and just went to bed. It was late. She ended up leaving to go out for lunch. And when she returned to her house, she saw men trying to steal her stereo equipment. And when she confronted them, one of the men pointed a gun at her, but she took off running. So now we have two men that are robbing homes in this area, just a few blocks away from Sherry's condo. And one of the suspects has a gun. So this is kind of fitting. Maybe it is this robbery gone wrong.
But there is some suspicious evidence, you could say, that at least tells police that there's a chance that this robbery gone wrong theory is flawed. And that's that only Sherry's car and her marriage license were taken. That car had been an engagement gift from John. All these items, they're very tied to their relationship.
Yeah, a marriage license? Who steals that?
And what kind of robber bites the victim?
That's something that whoever did this, I would just say a sexual deviant. This isn't just your regular everyday robber. And here we have this situation where she's been beaten and then shot. Now, this bite mark on her, at first I thought, well, maybe she had her arm around one of the robber's faces, and that was the only way the robber could get her to let go, was to bite into her arm. But the autopsy states that this bite mark was done while she was dying or shortly after she died. And that changes everything, because this means it didn't happen during the fight. This is something else.
It sounds personal.
Very.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Sherry's car was located 10 days later. The keys were inside of it. They couldn't find any damage, and nothing appeared to be stolen from inside the vehicle. The car was dusted. Nothing was found. No fingerprints, no evidence. We talked about the stalking that was apparently going on. Sherry's parents, they knew all about it. And because their daughter was murdered, they said, you don't have to look very far. You just have to investigate Officer Stephanie Lazarus. And they told them why.
But that kind of fell on deaf ears, right?
And I don't really understand. I guess I should understand. But it wasn't like Stephanie had been an officer for a long time. She'd only been a patrol officer for 2 years at that point. So why would anybody cover for her? Why didn't they just look into this? They had a very good motive, right? This woman was stalking Sherry because she was jealous of her, because she'd, quote unquote, taken her man.
Now, shortly after this murder, it was March 9th, 1986, Officer Stephanie called the Santa Monica PD to report that her car had been broken into, her gym bag stolen, all of her money and clothes that was in the bag, including a .38 caliber revolver. Now, at that time, the police did use .38 revolvers, mostly as backup weapons, but it was a standard issue weapon for the LAPD. That is a very popular gun, you know, a .38 special, Saturday night special. But at the same time, you have a woman that's been murdered, shot with a .38 caliber gun, and then you have a police officer who was stalking said woman and reports that her gun has been stolen less than 2 weeks later. I think someone could connect the dots there. That's just me. It is 1986, and Santa Monica PD is probably not talking to other police departments. So, yeah.
And apparently Stephanie didn't report this gun being stolen in the proper manner. She was supposed to inform the armory, but instead she just talked to the front desk. And on March 19th, she just purchased another weapon, a replacement, if you will.
Now, months have passed, and Sherry's parents start offering a $10,000 reward. They're holding press conferences, they're talking to the news outlets, and they're obviously not happy with the police response. For instance, that neighbor, Alan Tarski, the neighbor that John had spoken with, who had stepped into the condo and saw the carnage for himself, he was never interviewed by police. They didn't interview any of Sherry's family, like her sister, Teresa, who saw her on February 23rd. They didn't speak to her friend, Jane Goldberg, who knew about the stalking. I mean, they had written letters to the head of the LAPD about all of this. They had been contacting them and asking them, what are you going to do about this? They never got any responses because apparently they figured it was a burglary, a robbery, whatever, gone wrong.
Sherry's family reports that John kind of started slipping away. You can imagine he lost his wife and he's probably pretty upset. And everybody handles grief in their own way. John couldn't live in the condo anymore. He quit his job. He needed a change. So he moved away from Los Angeles. But I think her family was pretty upset because they were hoping that he would talk to the police and push them to do something.
They thought that he would take up this battle with them, you know, carry a torch for their dead daughter, his dead wife. Again, he wasn't considered a suspect, and her family did not consider him a suspect, obviously.
He went and moved in with his parents for several years. Another interesting thing happened. He went on vacation to Hawaii, and so did Stephanie. Apparently, he met up with her a couple times in 1990. But over all this time, Justin, the case just grows cold because the police believe it's a robbery gone wrong. They don't have any suspects. They have possible descriptions of a couple of Latino men, but that's it. And so over that course of time, Stephanie is just adding on years to her career at the LAPD.
She's very successful. She had worked as a treasurer for the LA Women's Police Officers Association. She helped raise money to provide childcare for children of police officers. And she actually ran a private investigation company. And she eventually married another detective that she worked with and fell in love with. She survived thyroid cancer and adopted a daughter. But police, when they did investigate this murder, they did do a lot of things right. They had a thing called a chronolog. It was chronological order log. They documented all these things and added to the report all the time. And in that report, it listed that Sherry's family had called in and asked if Stephanie was a suspect. They also swabbed that bite mark on Sherry, kept that as evidence for years.
And that brings us to 2008-2009, where Stephanie Lazarus is a full-fledged detective and promoted to the art theft detail. This is a highly respected officer, a highly respected detective.
Wasn't there an author who interviewed her at this point about art theft?
Matthew McGough.
Yeah. What was his impressions of her when he interviewed her?
Professional. That was the first word I think he said was she was very professional.
She's highly respected. I mean, she's been promoted multiple times. She's on different boards, does different things. Everyone looks up to her.
And not one disciplinary report in the 30 years that she'd been working there.
That's impressive. But the cold case squad, they're looking into Sherry's case. And it was February of 2009. This case is going to get a microscope put on it. And the only thing they had left was that swab from the bite mark. And they decided they would have that tested because now DNA is a thing.
Well, it was actually 5 years before when the LAPD had tested that bite swab and they found a DNA profile. It was a woman's DNA profile.
So 2004, they test this swab, find out it's female, but nothing's done with that for 5 years until this cold case team is looking at that and going, okay, so let's throw this DNA against our databases and upload it. They don't find any matches, but they go to that chronolog. There's huge gaps in it. They're missing tons of information, but they did see a name get mentioned once. It was Stephanie's name.
So there's this detective, Cliff Shepard. He's talking with the cold case squad about male and female burglary teams in the area. Remember, they're still looking at this as it could be a robbery gone wrong. So maybe there was a woman involved. He found out that there was a team that was one male, one female, operating in 1986. This could be a hit, right?
Yeah.
And this woman, they checked. She was not incarcerated or in custody during that time, but she was back in jail in 2009. They look at this and they determine that it wasn't her. So then they're looking back at the Lisa Rivoli robbery, which you had mentioned, and there are some things that don't quite match. Lisa's home had things stolen, like jewelry. The upper floor was disturbed. There was forced entry. And they left in their own car. They didn't steal any cars. So there are a lot of differences here. So they start reexamining the so-called robbery at Sherry's condo. And now that they're looking at it in a new light, they're looking at it and seeing a staged burglary. So they come up with a new theory.
Yeah, they're thinking this killer, they came in, they either had a key or were able to pick the lock, which that's different from all these other burglaries in the area. This person went into the home to specifically target Sherry, fired two shots, one of which missed and shattered that patio window. Now, I think initially when they saw this broken window, they thought maybe that's where the intruder came in. But all the glass was on the outside, so it had obviously been broken from the inside. They felt that Sherry got her intruder into a headlock, and that's when she was bit. The intruder eventually overpowered her and shot her. I think it's a good theory.
So the next step is to go back and talk with John Rutten. And they asked him, do you know any women who would want to hurt Sherry?
I think he does.
He does. And he comes up with the name Stephanie Lazarus. So the LAPD, this is many years later, decades later, they launch an investigation into Stephanie Lazarus that lasts for about 4 months. They want to get her DNA, and they're prepared to arrest her if there's a match. They also try to keep this operation very secret because, I guess, they're worried that someone will speak to her and tell her what's going on.
Blow the lid on all of it.
So they are planning this out, and when they write about Stephanie, they refer to her as Number 5.
And what was the name of the operation?
The Art Thief.
They're playing this off like they're investigating an art thief. And what department is Stephanie over right now?
That very thing, art theft. So it's interesting, though, the cold case squad, their office is right across the hall from Stephanie's. And that's their suspect. So they come into work and they're investigating Stephanie, and she's right across the hall, coming and going, obviously, and they see her all the time.
Yeah, and they're drinking coffee with her. They're shooting the breeze at the water dispenser down the hall. They have this DNA, so they wait for her to get like a glass of water, soda. She sets it down, and they run over there, and they grab the straw out of the cup, and they have that tested. What do they find?
They find stunning information. There was a 1.7 sextillion to 1 chance that the DNA did not belong to Stephanie Lazarus.
Sextillion. I don't know how many zeros that is, so I'm going to Google it real quick. It's 1,000 raised to the 7th power. It has 21 zeros behind it. You learn something new every day.
In other words, Stephanie is not just a suspect. She's the only suspect.
But how do they go about tricking a fellow police officer into talking to them and not letting them on that she is the one they're investigating? I mean, this is tricky.
That's where they need to get her to talk, and they'd prefer to do it in a controlled environment. So they need to continue the ruse for a little bit longer, don't they?
Yeah, they do get a couple other officers that do not know who Stephanie is. They don't care about her reputation. And they handpick these guys to do the interview.
June 5th, 2009. This is about 23 years after the murder of Sherry Rasmussen. Stephanie is in her office, and another officer approaches her and says, "We've got someone in custody, and they might have some information on a case you're working." So she gladly goes with this officer. And when they enter the jail, the officer has to turn in their weapon. And she does that. And then she's led to an interview room, and they ask her to sit down. I think at this point, she has some idea that they've tricked her.
Yeah. I mean, unless they're bringing in this guy immediately, or typically the guy would already be sitting there and they would have her come in. But she's the only one there. And they begin talking with her. And as anyone knows, the interview rooms are completely monitored.
But they try to put her at ease by saying, this is just a discussion. And that's what they put down on the paper.
I really want to give these guys credit because this was an amazing interrogation to watch. Immediately, she gets kind of defensive about being questioned in this basement interview room. But they tell her, like, if we did this upstairs, people would see us taking you into one of those rooms. There's eyes on those rooms, and you know rumors are going to spread. You've remarried. We don't want to question you about this situation, and people think the wrong thing. We're trying to respect you. We're trying to respect your decency and question you down here. And all we're trying to do is eliminate suspects in a case like we always do. But Stephanie knows that it's never that simple, right?
For those that are interested, you can watch the entire interview on YouTube. But these detectives, they're talking with Stephanie and they start to get to the real important stuff. They start asking her about John's wife, and she knows that Sherry was murdered. They ask her, do you remember her name? And she said, Shelley, Sherry. And the whole time she's talking, her actions are all greatly exaggerated. Her eye rolls, the way she moves her mouth, her body movements, everything is very like, I'm trying to remember back. And she just seems very nervous, would you say?
Yeah. I feel like unless you're a sociopath, most people can see right through your BS. It doesn't take an investigator. It doesn't take a seasoned police officer. You can watch interrogations and you know when that person's lying. You know when they're being put off. And, you know, with Stephanie, she's looking at them and going, you're trying to pin this on me. And that's just crazy.
The main point of this entire interview, this discussion, as they called it, was really to get Sherry to say that there would be no way that they would have her DNA like they do. They didn't have a physical altercation. Maybe they were around each other, but there was no way that she ever bit or attacked Sherry. And once they have that and they have the DNA, this is a done deal.
They asked her to submit a DNA swab, and she wasn't into that either. And she says something to the effect of, what, did Sherry and I get into a fight and then I decided to kill her? At that point, with that statement, the detectives are like, you know, Stephanie, you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. And they just go through her Miranda rights. Because they know up until that point, they can't really use anything she said against her in a court of law. But they're reading her her rights, and they tell her, you don't need to stay here. You don't need to talk to us. You are not under arrest. But we're just trying to figure out more about this case, and we're just trying to exclude you as a suspect. And they say, do you want to leave? What does she do?
She states that she needs to talk to a lawyer. And then she walks out. But they already have what they need.
Now, who's waiting for her outside of that interrogation room, Aaron?
The detectives who are waiting to arrest her. The police searched her home and they found diaries. One of the entries was, I found out that John is getting married. I was very depressed. They found photos of John in that diary. And she talked a lot about how the breakup was affecting her at work. They also noticed, though, that there was no diary entry about the car theft that she had reported.
The break-in where she lost her gun. Yeah.
They do some more searching. They look into her employee records. They find that she was off work from February 21st to the 24th and returned to work on the 25th. They couldn't find that there were any visible injuries on her person. But again, this is someone who went 30 years without anything on her record. So after her arrest, let's just say the rest of the department was pretty surprised.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GenY.
They have enough to take Stephanie Lazarus to trial, and that happens February 6, 2012. Shannon Presby is the deputy DA leading the prosecution, along with Paul Nunez. This trial lasted 3 weeks, and over 60 people testified.
Now, Mark Overland was Stephanie's defense attorney. He initially tried to get the whole case dismissed based on she should have been identified as a suspect from the get-go. And if you don't declare her a suspect, then this is all based on garbage DNA evidence that came out later. And all I can say, Aaron, is if you have to identify a suspect from the get-go, otherwise you need to throw the whole case out. Well, I guess we need to throw out all the cold cases that have ever been. I mean, it was just kind of a ludicrous argument that he tried to start out with, but he goes on to try to discredit the DNA evidence, right?
What else is he going to do? I mean, anybody who follows true crime, even casually, knows that what the prosecution has is damning. So give this attorney credit. They're doing what they're supposed to do.
You know, I guess he has some points. He's saying you're using DNA evidence that's been sitting around for a decade or two. You know, he's questioning how it was stored and if it was properly sealed. The blood smear on the wall, he says, well, that was an unidentified female and it didn't match Stephanie or John. But this is a blood smear from, you know, the 1980s. So I don't know if you could say it absolutely wasn't identifiable. They just didn't have the technology then. So the whole confrontation that happened between Stephanie and Sherry at the hospital is brought up in court. What happens there?
So what Mark Overland was doing was he was saying, Stephanie and Sherry, they did have a confrontation, but it's not the way the prosecution is painting it. See, the prosecution is saying, Sherry was confronted by Stephanie, who was threatening her. That's my guy, and I'm not going to give him up. But the defense here is saying, not so fast. It was Stephanie who was telling Sherry, tell your guy to leave me alone because you guys are engaged now. He's trying to contact me and get with me. And he says all those stalking claims, that's not true. So he's trying to play damage control here. He's saying, Stephanie is not this jealous person. She's not crazy. She wasn't that close with John, despite what the prosecution is saying, despite what some of these witnesses are saying. And he's going after that bite mark evidence. He said that the envelope that contained that swab, it had a tear in it. The vial was unsealed. And the envelope had been misplaced and wasn't located until they found it in the LA County Coroner's office. This is all they have. They don't have anything else. It's just this one swab. So he's basically saying, you can't put your whole case on this shaky evidence, this one piece of shaky evidence. They don't stop there. The defense also brought up that there was a fingerprint examiner who examined the stereo. They found fingerprints that didn't belong to Sherry, John, or Stephanie. And the Santa Monica PD records manager testified saying, there were two other car burglaries that happened on March 9th, 1986. So it could be that Stephanie did have a break-in into her car.
You know, the prosecution comes back with, she got rid of the murder weapon. This car break-in, she faked it. There is no real evidence besides that shaky police report. The prosecution is leaning on this DNA evidence hard, and they prepared a lot of circumstantial evidence to combat claims of evidence tampering, which could happen. But at that point, it's like in 2004, the evidence was being tested. So this would have been a long game for law enforcement to frame one of their own. It doesn't make sense. They talked about how this break into the condo looked staged. Nothing had been stolen, really. And why would they take a marriage license? And then, of course, they bring up Stephanie's history with John. There's a lot of other things here, a lot of other ties, a lot of other motives besides just, hey, there's a swab with her DNA on it.
The prosecution is going after a police detective here, which is a pretty serious thing. So they work from the angle of she misused her police training to kill Sherry Rasmussen and cover it up, which betrayed the trust of the entire LAPD. They're labeling her as a narcissistic, obsessed killer and saying, forget about the detective. This is a killer.
When you look at the details of how Sherry was murdered, it's brutal and kind of sadistic. But of course, John, her husband, he's the key to this, right? I mean, without him, all you have is this circumstantial evidence. So they put John up on the stand and he admitted in court to having an affair with Stephanie during his engagement and everything they did together. But the defense isn't going to appreciate this. So they're going to go with the husband did it scenario and they're going to blame John. When they cross-examine him, they're going to say, you know, John, he's the one that discovered her body. He's the one that was gone that day, just at the same time she was being murdered. He was the one that called multiple times while she was being murdered. If he was really that worried about her, wouldn't he have just come home?
But he decided to stop after and go to the bank and get shoes and pick up his dry cleaning.
If this was a husband did it scenario, yeah.
It's really just the defense grasping at straws because, sure, you can say those things and they sound intriguing, but they don't matter because Stephanie Lazarus's, as we call them, checkboxes, well, most of hers are filled in. What does John have? He's the husband, so he gets a check mark. But other than that, I mean, you might put another check mark for not coming home right away when his wife hasn't answered the phone all day. But I mean, how many people really suspect that something bad is going to happen?
They checked out his alibi at the time. You know, they can't really go back now, decades later, and check it because does that company he worked at even exist anymore? Are there the punch clock cards? Are they still around? So all we have to go on is what they did at that time.
March 8th, 2012, after an hour of deliberation, the jury found Stephanie Lazarus guilty of first-degree murder. And on May 11th, Stephanie was sentenced to 27 years in prison with the possibility of parole.
Ouch. You know, the jury, they took everything into consideration. And when you have a case like this, DNA evidence, that's what everyone wants, is why was your DNA at this location at this time, specifically on the victim? There's no explaining that away. If you're not supposed to be there, then why is your DNA there? And there's no conspiracy. There's no frame-up job here because Stephanie is a police officer. If anything, they're going to protect her, not frame her.
One of the big questions in this case is, what if they had looked at Stephanie Lazarus in 1986? Some people really believe that she would have still gotten away with it because they wouldn't have had that DNA evidence. I kind of question that because they did have a bite mark and they did have the reports of her stalking Sherry. And then, of course, you have the relationship with John. I feel like there was enough there that they could have worked that case, but that's just my own feeling. How do you feel about that?
I think that they did have a lot and they could have come to that same conclusion, but without the DNA evidence, not sure if a jury would find her guilty or not.
So in a way, this worked out the way it should have, maybe.
Yeah.
Because now that they've got her, she's not getting out of this. I mean, she might get out of prison eventually because she was sentenced to 27 years and does have the possibility of parole, but they have DNA on her.
I did a lot of reading on this case, Aaron, and I watched some YouTube videos, and a lot of them frame this case as an LAPD cover-up of one of their own. a lot of the coverage at the time, because when this case hit the news, it was a big deal. You have a love triangle, you have a cop murdering an innocent woman. It was a big deal. And initially I'm looking at this and I think, I don't know if I want to jump to this was a conspiracy, this was a cover-up. I don't know if I think malice when they never investigated her, and then you have some evidence that was destroyed, this chronologue that they had kept a running tally of everything that was happening. You have big gaps in that. People look at all this and they absolutely think this was intentional. They absolutely were not going to investigate one of their own. And again, normally I wouldn't say this is a conspiracy, this is a cover-up. But sadly, the LAPD's track record at around this time and into the 90s was horrid. There's a whole book written about Notorious B, Biggie Smalls, and a cover-up surrounding that. And then you have the Rampart scandal. So whereas I can look at a case like this on its own and think, I think that they just didn't know what to investigate. And eventually things started coming out and they did the right thing. And when they did identify one of their own as the suspect, they moved quickly and they moved quietly and very strategically, and they did the right thing. But I can't help looking back at the 80s and 90s at all these other scandals that the LAPD had and not think, well, maybe there is merit to them covering this up. Maybe there is merit that some of these logs were intentionally disposed of. I don't know, you know?
It's difficult for me to say. I can see why they focused on the robbery gone wrong. I don't feel like the evidence really supports that, but I can see why they got off on that. But for me, I think it just sort of became tunnel vision for them. And that's where you could take this through different departments, and other departments probably would have got it right. I will say that there was a detective on the case back in 86 who disputed the Rasmussen's claims. They said, we told him about Sherry's problems with Stephanie. And he said, no, they never told me that. So you could wonder, is he just lying? Because I don't feel the Rasmussens were lying. So what does it say about this detective?
Yeah, I don't think the Rasmussens would just make this up. There were multiple people all in the know. Her family would end up trying to file several lawsuits against the LAPD. One was dismissed as time barred, meaning that the statute of limitation had passed for them to sue the LAPD for this. And the other one was a whistleblower lawsuit that a criminalist named Jennifer Francis had filed. At the time, she alleged that there was misconduct in this investigation surrounding the DNA evidence. And that one actually ended in the city's favor. And they said that there was no evidence of any misconduct. So both the family and this criminalist had sued, but nothing came of either of those civil suits. It's a crazy case. I thoroughly enjoyed researching it and reading about it. There is a book out there that you can read if you want to hear a lot more. It goes way more in depth into the trial and evidence and arguments that were made. What's this book, Aaron?
It's The Lazarus Files by Matthew McGough. His last name is spelled McGough. And he has interviews available on YouTube as well. I've watched some of them, and we had talked about it earlier. He had met Stephanie Lazarus because he was looking into this art theft and found her to be very professional. But of course, as things developed, well, he started forming a book in his mind, and it was published in 2019. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.